Well, hello and welcome to another edition of the KKFI Arts Magazine Show. I'm Michael Hogue, your host. Glad to have you with us as you are listening live to the KKFI Arts Magazine Show right here on KKFI 90.1 FM, your community radio station, right here in Kansas City. Great things to bring your way in the course of the show today. Nice contrast in the interviews we'll be doing today. And that's always fun for me. You know, go from something fun to something more fun. but we get serious sometimes, too. It's like the comedian Marty Feldman, he once said to Johnny Carson, "Can I be serious for a moment?" And Johnny Carson said, "Well, yes, of course." And Marty Feldman went on and was just even more ridiculous than before. But we will be serious during the course of the program today. The 58th season of the Kansas City Ballet concludes with their new show, Rite of Spring. It will include one world premiere, three Kansas City premieres, and here to tell us all about it, boy, some important people. They always bring me the most important people to talk to me about the shows going on. Devin Carney is with us once again. He is the artistic director of the Kansas City Ballet Company. Hails from New Orleans. Comes to us via Cincinnati. Danced himself. Has worked at several different places. And glad to have you in Kansas City once again.
Well, it's wonderful to be here again. I love it.
You brought along with you Adam Hoagland, who is the choreographer for the anchor work of the evening, Rite of Spring, which is the title name of the ballet itself. He hails from Dallas. He spent some time in New York City going to Juilliard.
Mm-hmm.
Very impressive, Adam. But he's worked all over the place, as Devin told me. He's now living in England. He's worked in Holland and also for the Manchester International Festival and probably a lot of places as well.
All around.
Puts in a lot of time on those planes crossing the Atlantic.
That's right.
Do you wish you were based maybe a little more centrally?
Well, it's very good to be mysterious and sort of run off to England, I think, after each of these performances.
Is that because you do more work with the Manchester Festival?
No, I'm basically based in Bristol, England, currently. My partner and I have a home there and a dog and a very sort of normal suburban life. Yeah. But my career is basically this side of the pond. And, you know, I've been choreographing for ballet companies in the States for over 10 years now, and it's, I go home quite a bit, but, you know, this is what I love to do, so.
What is that? And we'll get to Rite of Spring in a moment, but I can't help but be curious, the difference between dance and ballet in Europe and England and over here. Is there a difference in style?
Oh, definitely, definitely. I think American dancers, well, the reason I like working with American dancers and American ballet companies in particular is because they have a real sense of drive and purpose and a real commitment to, you know, basically trying anything you would ask of them. They're very hardworking and, you know, it's just that kind of American mentality of sort of, you know, there's that kind of healthy sense of competition and, you know, we can do anything if we put our mind to it. Whereas you work someplace that's sort of, you know, kind of a more like a European opera house sort of tradition and everything is sort of like steeped in so much tradition that it's almost like, oh, well, we could do that today or maybe wait till tomorrow or should we have coffee now or, you know, it's not as like urgent.
Oh,
and
sure.
I like that immediacy and that urgency and that kind of energy that exists over here.
Well, sir, did you, Devin, recruit him to come here? How did that all come about?
Well, I've known Adam for almost all of, I didn't realize it's only been 10 years. What an incredible career for 10 years of choreography.
Well, I think I started in 2000 was my first, like, real professional.
Oh, okay, so it's been more like 15, 16 years.
Oh,
but
wow.
For about 10 of those, well, 13 of those, I've had a chance to work with him when I was associate artistic director at Cincinnati Ballet. He had an already ongoing established relationship with that company, and so from time to time he came in and was doing works on the company. You know, they were small at first in terms of their scope of number of dancers, and then this work came along, Rite of Spring, which was his first big work that Cincinnati Ballet had the opportunity to perform, and that's when I saw his work for the first time, which ultimately the work that I really desired to see here for the Kansas City audiences and for Kansas City Ballet he had a chance to do.
So is Rite of Spring now the one that you're known for right now?
Oh, well, it's definitely getting a lot of, chances to be seen. And it was a really fun work to create. I love the music. It was very inspiring. I made it for the Louisville Ballet, where I'm resident choreographer, in 2009. So it's since been done in Cincinnati and Tulsa and now here. So I'm very proud of it.
Yeah, sure.
It's a very challenging work for the dancers. It involves the entire company. It's very physically demanding, but also very mm-hmm. theatrical. So it kind of combines all the things that I, really like.
Does the ballet tell a story within itself?
Well, it does. I mean, there's sort of depicts a society that is sort of completely disconnected from anything that is natural or of the earth, or, they're very kind of drained and empty and kind of ghost-like. And there is a woman appears who is sort of the complete antithesis of that. She is beautiful, she is fresh, she is alive, and they sort of, dance her to death, practically. So it's a dark sort of ritualistic sacrifice, but that's sort of what the ballet has always been about. And it's just me trying to find a new, spin on it, and something that's a little more timely and about the world we live in today.
Yeah, finding a new spin on it. I'd love to follow up on that. Is that difficult sometimes?
Yeah, I watched all different versions of it a lot before I started to think about making my own version, and that was very intimidating because there have been so many incredible choreographers that have tackled this music, and it's a little intimidating, but, I think you just walk into the room and I'm really good at sort of deleting that sort of information and then just going from, let's push play and listen to this first note and then see what happens.
So it's very important to just find something, and it's special anyway, something more special, if I can put it that way.
Yeah,
in the piece.
Yeah, it's just, I love music, and I think that it's always about exploring the music with the dancers in the room, with me, as if we're hearing it for the first time and treating it like something that is fresh and is brand new. And giving it that sort of life again.
When you come to a place like Kansas City here, did you have certain dancers in mind, or did Devin have some ideas, I suppose?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah, yes, he was like planting little seeds in my head over a year ago, actually.
Over a year ago, wow.
Yeah, he's like, oh, you're going to love this one and this one. I thought, oh, okay, we'll see. And he was right. Yeah, I'm very happy. This is my first time working with the company, so I didn't know them so well coming in, but what's nice about doing this work as a sort of getting to know a company project is that it involves everyone, and they all have to sort of get into this sort of dancing, this material that is you have to be so exactly together and on the beat, and everyone has to move with the same breath and the same sort of intensity, and it really kind of unifies them, and it's nice to do that and sort of see, who really grabs it, who really, is inspired by it themselves, who kind of gets my movement vocabulary. So it's, if I came to make a brand new piece and I'd never seen the dancers, that gets a little intimidating because you're not really sure, oh, I don't know that person. What's their thing? What's their special thing that makes them different? So I like with this, it's nice to, kind of discover them through something that I already know works. This piece I feel good about, and I can see, them kind of coming out in it.
If they're a professional ballet dancer, they're good, and they can probably adapt to things, but do you want them to be particularly, I'm just following up on something I heard you say, particularly inspired by the piece? That is much better?
Definitely. You want them to really, it's a hard... It's not fun to dance.
No.
I wouldn't say it's fun to dance, but I think they get a lot of out of the sort of intensity of it, and it's so brutal, and it's so, you have nothing left. by the end. And I think that they really enjoy giving themselves that fully. You know, you can't hold back at all.
Certainly. Who are the dancers involved? I'll let
who?
Them. Yeah.
Well, then, almost the whole company. There's an ensemble, of which he mentioned are those, this, you know, kind of soulless, empty society that's the ensemble. And that's 20 dancers.
Wow.
10 women, 10 men. So that incorporates a lot of the company. It's not every single dancer because we're doing a lot more on the program, so other dancers are in other pieces. And then there's this one person called, which is her, she has a title called The Chosen One, and that one person.
Yeah. Yeah, I should ask about costumes and things like this. This is spring. We're dancing among the lilacs and certain pieces. Maybe not this piece.
No, not quite.
What about the costuming and all of that? The full sense of course, the music helps out quite a bit. But the full sense of spring, you know, things turning over and reproducing. And things
You're talking about the whole program as a
whole
overarching experience. Mm-hmm. Yes, there's definitely that sense of spring, which was somewhat purposeful on my part. And I really wanted to have this, you know, we're doing our final show. It's springtime. Why not, you know, see a lot of different representations of maybe what choreographic artists think of spring. Uh-huh. You know, or things that would reflect perhaps a sense of spring or renewal, you know. The first piece, you know, is you mentioned lilacs. It's done by Yuri Posokov, and that work is called Diving Into the Lilacs. And it's probably a perfect work for this program to start the evening because it is so, it literally has a backdrop, a back scenery. There's scenery in the background that are all lilac bushes. And all the dancers are in these beautiful colors, only true colors of lilacs. So you've got all these different colors ranging from just off-white to deep, rich purples. And, you know, and so you really get this, like, almost, it's almost like I have this secret idea, which I, of course, can't do, but I would love to just spray, you know, lilac-scented air freshener into the air ventilation systems at the Kauffman Center because you can almost smell lilacs in this work.
I think that's a great idea.
Except for the people who are allergic to it.
Well, it could be like a scratch and sniff.
Yeah, scratch and sniff on the program.
So if you wish to inhale lilac.
There you go.
On the program.
He's got it.
Great idea, Adam. And on the scratch-off, they would have
So then the next work is by, Yuri Posokov is the one. He comes from San Francisco Ballet, where he's resident choreographer, and has had a lovely career out there, both as a dancer and now as a choreographer. And he's very sought after, which is really exciting to have both Adam's work and Yuri's work on the same program.
Oh, yeah.
But, just wait. If you order before midnight tonight, there's even more, and that is Viktor Plotnikov's work called Vesna. Now, he hails from the Northeast, Boston area, and his work is a world premiere, and that's to the music of Dvorak's New World Symphony, the second movement, Largo, which is beautiful to hear the Kansas City Symphony playing live at all the performances, of course. And his work, Vesna, it translates into the word spring. It's Czech, Czechoslovakian. It's Czech for spring. And his work is as well about this sort of awakening that occurs at spring, you know, in both us as humans as well as in nature. So there's this real sense of, like, something's growing and something's coming back to life in his work. And then the next work is by Helen Pickett, who comes from Atlanta Ballet, where she's resident choreographer there, and has had an incredible career internationally, staging and choreographing her work all over the world. And that work's called Petal, not like a bicycle petal, but a flower petal, make that clear. And it is the most vibrant, colorful work I think I've ever seen in terms of just its actual visuals. The whole thing is done in a white box, basically, with white walls, on the sides. There are no wings. It's white walls, and it's a white backdrop, and it's a white floor. And then the lighting is thrown into this white box, basically, of yellows and oranges and blue and kind of a purple red. And it's very striking to see a stage that full of color, and your eyes, I wish your audience could see me, but you know, your eyes just get wide because you just, all this color, it's like, whoa, I'm tripping out. There's so much of this color on stage. It's very intense color. And it's very immersive in terms of this feeling of color. You know, it's been equated to the piece, the lighting, as Easter colors. And I really love that it's named Petal and that it has all these colors, really, that we kind of, you know, equate to Easter, which is, again, spring, right?
Sure.
And then, of course, there's Adam's work, which is Rite of Spring, which is an incredible work, which is kind of like this concluding entity within the program, which is just so intense, it's so visceral, it's so emotional, and it's so hard-hitting and ritualistic. You know, this music is famous, Michael. This music is so famous, this Rite of Spring. Done in 1913 was the first time that Rite of Spring was performed. And it was actually performed, the music was created for the premiere, okay, in Paris. It was created for dance, which is really cool to have a piece of music that old that was commissioned for dance. It was extremely ahead of its time musically. I mean, when the curtain went up on the very first performance, and this is, you know, I don't think we ever hear of this anymore these days, but there was such an emotional, physical reaction by the audience, okay, that they were screaming, there was booing, there was cheering, there were people swinging punches at each other in the audience. And Stravinsky literally was telling the conductor, don't stop, play on, keep playing. And then he rushed backstage, and because there was so much commotion going on in the house, in the audience, that they turned up the house lights so that the police could find the people who were causing the most trouble, right? And so they had to turn up the house lights in the middle of the show, and they left them up, right? But the dancers and the orchestra kept playing on, and they got to the end. And it was choreographically by Nijinsky was this first work that was done to this music. It was so controversial in its musical force that had then come onto the musical scene. And of course, you know, it has become quite frankly, it's like a mountain. It's like a mountain that a choreographer has to climb. And it's critical in a choreographer's career, I think, that they get the opportunity to have their hand at such an incredible piece of music. And, you know, I'm thrilled with what Adam has done with this music. It brings the music to life. It really does. You can hear, you know, you can see the music, all right, and through Adam's work. It is such a musical work that he's created. He is extreme. He is a musician at heart. You can tell in the way he choreographs. It ties with the music so amazingly well. And it's just, you know, overall, between all these four works, it's a really interesting program, which I had the opportunity, you know, when we get to the very end of a rehearsal period like this, we have a few last run-throughs before we head to the theater, right? And so on Saturday, we had our run-through with all four works being done in order that they will be performed in, right? Normally, one thing's being rehearsed at this time, another thing's being rehearsed at that time. Two worse pieces are being rehearsed simultaneously. But, you don't get a chance to really see what the program's going to look like until you're just about to hit the theater. And so to see all four of these works back-to-back in the chronological order they're going to be seen by our audiences in, it made me just realize how amazing the artists of Kansas City Ballet are. And it's going to demonstrate the versatility and the breadth of movement quality and artistry that Kansas City Ballets have grown, Kansas City Ballet dancers have grown to become, that they can handle these four different works, and they're very different works. And they're all beautiful works, but they all have their own movement vocabulary because all these choreographers are very specific in their choreographic voices, and none of them are the same, which is really cool to see this kind of program come together. And one last thing about the program, which I think is really kind of cool, and I don't know if anyone's ever done this, frankly. It wasn't what I'd say intentional. It's just that I'm drawn to very good choreographers, okay? But this entire program is created by resident choreographers of other companies. Every single choreographer, starting with Yuri Pasikov from resident choreographer San Francisco Ballet, Victor Plotnikov, resident choreographer Festival Ballet of Providence, Helen Pickett, resident choreographer of Atlanta Ballet, and concluding with Adam Hoagland, who's not just resident choreographer of one company, but of two companies. So in reality, I have five resident choreographers. But it's completely done by respected, internationally known creators, and I think that's really exciting for the Kansas City audiences to have all of that in one viewing. It's a very exciting evening.
Certainly. I remember on one of your previous visits, you brought your lighting person.
Right, Chad Burns.
He spoke in great detail about he mixed the light and made it so much more a factor than it would have been in the dance. Is that something you appreciate along with the music?
Yeah, I'm very into the scenic design of the production and into the lighting and the costume. That is as important as the steps or the music to me. You know, it's all part of creating that sort of unified vision.
In radio, we try to create an image, you know, paint a picture with words. What you were able to do when you were talking about the colors was just outstanding.
Oh.
I'm sure people now want to see all those colors blended together.
It's really cool. It's worth the look, that's for sure.
Rite of Spring is the overall name of the piece, but it features four pieces. A One World premiere, three Kansas City premieres, opens up this Friday, May 6th, 7:30 at the Kauffman Center for the Performing Arts. Performances continue on Saturday the 7th at 7:30, a matinee on Sunday the 8th at 2 o'clock p.m. Performances then continue Friday the 13th, Friday the 13th at 7:30 p.m., Saturday the 14th at 7:30 p.m., and conclude with a matinee on Sunday afternoon at 2 o'clock p.m. on the 15th at the Kauffman Center for the Performing Arts. You can go online to look things over, get some more information, kcballet.org, or you can call their ticket office at 816-931-8993. We're speaking with Devin Carney and Adam Hoagland from the Kansas City Ballet Company, talking about this, this what sounds like it's going to be a very vibrant, renewing, and that was your word, piece that will be going on. Is that the way you look at it, a renewal of things? And every time, Adam, you do this show, do you think of perhaps renewing what you did before or something
good
else?
Good question.
Well,
it is a
representation of where I was artistically when I created it in 2009. So there is, I don't know, I worry that if I sort of, because you know your tastes change, you get bored of doing things a certain way, want to try something, but I always think of it as like a very, you know, it's like when you play that Jenga game where you pull one little piece out and then the whole thing falls over.
Yep.
I'm really scared of sort of fiddling too much because I worry that the whole feeling could possibly get messed up, or you know, I think it kind of works the way it is, and I always will, you know, if there's a way, like a lift doesn't fit quite well, or, you know, somebody can't do a step to that side, you know, it's little teeny-weeny things that you would never notice I might play with, but the real, like, meat of it gets left alone.
I did want to mention one other thing when he's talking about, you know, fiddling with his work too much, and that was in the original creative process. We didn't talk about this. He actually created the role of the chosen one, that's the lead female, on one of the living greatest American female ballerinas who just recently retired from New York City Ballet, Wendy Whalen. And he had a friendship with her, and he actually created that chosen one, that particular role on her, because she was a Louisville native, Kentucky native. And so she was interested in the idea of collaborating with Adam and doing something for her home company back in Louisville, Kentucky. So he created this work, and he made her portions of the work not in Louisville, but in New York City. Do you want to maybe talk a little bit more about that? I think you would be able to say more about it.
So Wendy and I created everything that she danced together at the studios of the School of American Ballet. And then I went to Louisville, worked with the company, created everything they did in about 2 or 3 weeks. Then she came and we had a few days, 4 or 5, to put the whole thing together before we went to this theater. So it was really like she was this transplanted alien.
Yeah. Which is really cool.
Which is what the work feels like.
Yeah. Well, I bet so. Yeah. Sounds exciting. You paint a great word picture of
it.
Rite of Spring opens again this Friday, the 6th, at the Kauffman Center for the Performing Arts. Go online, kcballet.org, or call their number, 816-931-8993, to learn more about Rite of Spring, one world premiere, 3 Kansas City premieres that conclude the 58th season. I would ask you to review it, but we're almost out of time because you said this was quite a season for you.
Oh, the season as a whole. I know. My goodness. We started with Three Musketeers, big Kansas City premiere, and then we did Nutcracker, brand new. Remember, full-length production of the Nutcracker, which was incredibly successful. And then right after that, I did a staging of a full-length Swan Lake, first time the company had ever done Swan Lake. And then we did New Moves, which had 6 world premieres at our home studios, the Todd Bollinger Center for Dance and Creativity, and now this amazing conglomeration of these 4 beautiful works all on one program. What a season for the 58th closer. It's just really exciting.
Congratulations on
that. Thank you.
I want to thank my guest, Devin Carney, the artistic director of the Kansas City Ballet, and Adam Hoagland, guest choreographer and resident choreographer for not one, but two opera companies. Thanks so much for coming to Kansas City and being on the program.
It was so much fun.
Loved hearing your perspective on there. That was quite educational, as a matter of fact. We're going to take a break. When we return, we're going to talk about one of the classic musicals that's being performed down in Leawood. When we return, you're listening to the Arts Magazine radio program right here on KKFI, 90.1 FM.
Hi, I'm Russ Simmons with Freeze Frame, KKFI's weekly look at the newest cinematic fare at your local theaters. Key and Peele's first feature film together may be a one-joke affair, but it's a very funny joke. Fans of the duo's Comedy Central sketch show will love Keanu, a raunchy, irreverent satire, and so will many newcomers. The comics play nerdy cousins who pose as hardcore drug dealers in an effort to regain a stolen kitty. There's enough violence, drugs, and foul language in this gleefully goofy romp to easily earn an R rating, but the vibe is so sweet-natured that it's almost inoffensive. This Keanu is one cool cat. Jennifer Aniston, Kate Hudson, Julia Roberts, and Kansas City's Jason Sudeikis star in Gary Marshall's latest holiday comedy, Mother's Day. This ensemble sitcom weaves several stories about a number of folks as they prepare for the Mother's Day celebrations in Atlanta. The humor is forced, the sentiment is artificial, and the story is chock full of awkward stereotypes. Undemanding audiences may find something to like in this extremely lightweight effort. It's odd that a movie about one of the world's greatest writers is so poorly written. Giovanni Ribisi plays a Miami newspaper writer who befriends Ernest Hemingway, played by stage actor Adrian Sparks, in Papa Hemingway in Cuba. This tired biopic wastes a good cast and the stunning Cuban scenery on a colorless cardboard portrait of the renowned novelist who battled writer's block, depression, and alcoholism in his final years. Papa deserves better. Gabriel Byrne, Jesse Eisenberg, and Isabelle Huppert star in Louder Than Bombs, a thoughtful, well-acted, and profoundly sad look about how one family deals with grief after a tragic event. It's smart, observant, and involving, but it never quite achieves the level of emotional devastation it was aiming for. Also opening this week, the first Monday in May, is a documentary about the Metropolitan Museum of Art's fashion show, China Through the Looking Glass. Well, that's it for this edition of Freeze Frame. Until next time, I'm Russ Simmons with Fox 4 and KKFI-FM. Freeze Frame!
Join me, Diana Lynn, every Tuesday morning from 6 to 8 a.m. for the Tasty Brew edition of Your Morning Buzz. You will hear the distinctive roots-oriented sounds of the best in Americana, bluegrass, and country music from local, regional, national, and international artists like Sarah Morgan, Chad Elliott, Emmylou Harris, and Sturgill Simpson. Tune in Tuesdays, 6 to 8 a.m. More information at kkfi.org or on Facebook at Tasty Brew Music.
And welcome back to the Arts Magazine Show right here on KKFI 90.1 FM, your community radio station right here in Kansas City. I'm Michael Hogue, your host, part of the Arts lineup here on KKFI. On Monday, we have Arts Magazine. On Wednesday, we have Art Speak Radio with Maria, and Maria often has guests from the artistic community. She actually expands beyond that on some days. Sometimes other programmers will kick in with guests from the arts community, trying to keep Kansas City better and more fully informed. In fact, that was a slogan of the station years ago, keeping Kansas City fully informed of what's going on in the arts community all around town. It's very important. It's a community that often is underreported. So you need to listen to us. You really do. Part of the Arts Lineup right here on KKFI. Well, we're going to talk about one of the classic musicals of all time, perhaps. My Fair Lady, the musical version of Pygmalion. I always like to say that because a lot of people don't realize that it was from the book Pygmalion that all of this happened. It's a production of the Leawood Stage Company, and with us to tell us all about their version of My Fair Lady is Kevin Bogan. He is the director, always involved with a musical, Kevin.
Yes.
You prefer musicals?
Yes, I do. Mm-hmm. Music is my background. Yeah, I started playing the piano when I was six, and I've always loved music. So it's a great challenge to put music with the acting and everything that goes along with it. Takes everything to another level, brings more emotions to the show, I think. So it's a lot of fun to do.
Oh, sure. And also Brian Larius is with us. He plays the role of Henry Higgins, trying to reform and, I guess, better educate the young lady to bring her up to standards.
Absolutely. Make a new human being out of her.
Was that his... I don't know. What were his motives in doing that, without giving away any plot?
Well, yeah, I think at this point there are probably a few plot lines that we can withhold that people would know. But, you know, he's egged on by Pickering to take this person, this gutter snipe, if you will, with horrible English, and make her into essentially a new human being by teaching her to speak properly. That's the whole foundation of his. Can we really change a person by giving them a better language? Forget money, forget station in life. Will language actually make that difference? And so that's what he sets himself out to do. And succeed he does.
Yeah, well, that's a classic scientific argument, I guess. Are we born to be the way we are? Or is it a question of education, circumstances, all of that? That's been a controversy that went way back. In fact, the author probably dealt with that in his own ways.
Exactly.
All throughout his life.
Yeah.
And he wrote Pygmalion, and at some point, and I don't have those details, I didn't have the time to look it up, it was turned into a musical.
Yes, it came to Broadway in 1957. Lerner Lowe wrote the music for it. Famous actress played Eliza Doolittle, you've probably heard of her, Julie Andrews.
Oh, yes.
Yes, it was her second Broadway musical, actually. She did The Boyfriend first, and they saw her in The Boyfriend and thought she would be fantastic for My Fair Lady, and they asked her to do it. But when it went to film, they did not ask her to do it.
Yeah.
Yeah, so
this happens.
Yeah, it happens a lot.
It does. Henry Higgins was played. Well, the one I associate with it is Rex Harrison.
That's right. He pretty much established how the role would be played for all time.
They even did a car commercial years ago. What was it, a Chrysler?
I believe
commercial?
It was, yes.
Yeah, where he incorporated some of his lines from the show into the commercial, which, of course, only publicized the show even more.
Of course. Right. And it's interesting because, you know, you bring in the Pygmalion relationship, but Shaw did not want it done as a musical. He had been burned before, and it wasn't until he died that they went ahead and went forward with it. So if he'd had his way, we'd have not had this iconic piece of art.
Well, I'm curious now. What did he object to? Well, how was he burned? In a
I don't remember what the other piece was. I was just reading about this morning, but one of his other pieces had been adapted into a musical, and it was a complete disaster. So he vowed that he would not let that happen again. And so he said no to Pygmalion being turned into a musical. And it wasn't until he died, and I think 1950, that the individual had the rights then move forward and contacted Lerner and Loda to do that show. And oddly, Richards and Rogers had tried to do Pygmalion before and found it impossible. They could not do it. And they abandoned it. And shortly after Lerner and Lowe went to make the piece, they reached out to them and said, oh, you're wasting your time. This can't be turned into a musical. Well, they were wrong, and the critics confirmed that. So.
Yeah. Well, you know, it depends on the circumstances.
Absolutely.
Sometimes there's a right time to do something, and sometimes there's never time to do something. But in this, when it found its time in its place, it worked.
It worked.
Yeah. You and your relationship with your musical director, they're classic songs. They're known. These are the kind of songs, and I say this all the time, but it's as true in this show as anything else. Sometimes people will know the song, not immediately recognize what show it's from.
Right.
People will ask me, what show is that from? this is one of those shows.
So probably the most famous song from the whole show is I Could Have Danced All Night, that Eliza sings when she's kind of reformed and kind of gotten the speech pattern down. But it also has great songs like On the Street Where You Live, that Freddie sings, and Get Me to the Church on Time, and A Little Bit of Luck. It's really a cavalcade. Almost every song is a singable song that the audience will be singing along with. And we encourage that. We'd love for them to sing along. Interesting part of our production is that we'll have an orchestra, a 30-piece orchestra, but we'll also have, in addition to that, a 60-voice choir every night that will supplement the big choral numbers. So it'll be something different that you've never seen in a production before.
Yeah. You wanted to get more voices?
That's right. That's right.
You're going to be performing this at a different location than what you've done before, at the United Methodist Church of the Resurrection, 13720 Rowe Avenue, Leawood, Kansas. Not at the usual, but not far from the usual Leawood Stage Company location.
That's right. It's our first partnership with the United Methodist Church of the Resurrection. So we're using a lot of members of their orchestra, a lot of members of their choir as well, using their space, some of their scenery that they use for their Christmas musical this year. So it kind of all worked out for a great partnership.
Yeah, nice tie-in. Is it because the church, the sound just reverberates more in a church than it does in the building?
It certainly does in that building. And it also gives us 3,000 seats to use.
Wow.
So that's really nice. So everybody will have a great seat.
You're expecting to fill every single
seat. We would love to fill every seat. We would love to fill every seat.
Yeah, it's a big place.
Yeah. We also have the use of the IMAG, so everything will be up on big screens too, so you'll be able to see the intricacies of the acting on the big screen. So that would be great.
Yeah, this is very professional.
Yeah.
You're going big time.
We are. We've taken a step up.
The success of the Christmas shows in that space, did that inspire Leawood Stage Company to do this?
I think so, yeah. We've been very successful with our Christmas shows. We do 5 performances every year of that. So it's going to be a great outlet for both groups. So we're very excited about the partnership.
The show opens this Thursday, May the 5th at 7:30 p.m. Performances continue on Friday the 6th at 7:30 p.m. and on Saturday the 7th at 7:30 p.m. at the United Methodist Church of the Resurrection, 13720 Rowe Avenue, Leawood, Kansas. Now, the last time I went to the location in the park, and it was not the summer show. It was the fall show. Doesn't matter. Uh-huh. There was some road blockages going down south. Does that still exist?
There's no road blockages coming from north to south. Coming from south, way off to the east, there are some, but it's not very much anymore. Good. So you should be okay.
Good. People need to know this, especially if they have 3,000 people there. That's very important. The number to call for more information, and I have 2. Which one is the one I should? There is a 913-339-6700, extension 157. Is that the one you would prefer?
Yes, that's the best one.
That's the best one? Mm-hmm. Okay. Or you can go online to leawoodstageco.org. Speaking again, of course, with Kevin Bogan, the director, and Brian Larios, who plays the role of Henry Higgins. I guess the selection of an Eliza Doolittle is most important in this show.
Yes. Our Eliza Doolittle is Katie Bartow. She's a local actress. She's fantastic. She's just really captured the essence of the role. The thing I like most about My Fair Lady is the book is so strong. The songs are iconic, of course, but the book coming mainly from what Shaw wrote. I mean, the words are almost exactly what Shaw wrote in the play. So you have a great book to work from, too. So we've done a lot of character study and scene work with the two actors, Katie and Brian, and they've just created these beautiful scenes that you probably have not seen before My Fair Lady acted the way they act them. So I'm anxious for people to embrace that and see that as well.
Yeah, what other performers grace the stage?
We have Dennis Maddox is playing Colonel Pickering. Ray Anger is playing Alfred P. Doolittle. Christoph Geis is playing Freddy. And Laurie Arnold is playing Mrs. Higgins.
Sure.
And, you know, I'll say as a member of the cast and removing myself from this, but we've all gone to see shows, and there's one or two in a cast, and you go, oh, they were good, but they're weak in some areas. I think every one of the voices in this cast is just so strong. You find yourself in the wings listening to your castmates performing, and you're just captivated by how good they are. So I think people are really going to be impressed with the vocal quality and the acting quality that they're going to get in the show.
Yeah, it's you know, like I said, it's a classic show. They've heard of it, but as time goes by, and I don't think it's been done. Maybe it's Starlight, but I don't think it's been done by a company for a while. Did that factor into the planning as well?
We tried to plan the season this year. The season is My Fair Lady, Sweeney Todd, and the summer we're doing Once on a Mattress. Oh. So we tried to plan the season around those three musicals to give us you know, kind of a perspective on English music. So that's kind of how it came about.
Yeah. That's Sweeney Todd.
Yeah.
That's something else. Which version are you doing? There's a couple of different versions.
I don't really know. I'm not involved with that.
Oh, okay.
I think they're probably doing the original, the traditional version. I don't. Yeah. I know they're not playing instruments. So it won't be that.
Yeah, that's a real razor sharp one. That is.
Sure it is. That's true.
Sure, yeah. Well, yeah. My Fair Lady is just more of a family show.
Yeah, absolutely.
It kind of fits into the British aristocracy type thinking, at least in the words and thinking of Higgins and his the man who made the bet with him. Yes, as in a lot of shows like this, I guess I'm thinking of the Michael Todd movie, Around the World in 80 Days.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That began with a bet as well, as does this one.
Yes, yes.
The and British and their wagering.
Oh, yes, absolutely. And the other thing that's quite interesting is, of course, and having come off the Downton Abbey age, where we know more about aristocracy than we have in the past. It's just, so, you know, some of the notes you get, well, it's a servant, don't look at them, and don't talk to them, and servant, never talk to that person, you know. So it's very British, and it's a very much a class system that is very foreign to the way we operate in the States, but it's been challenging and interesting.
Well, that's so. Yeah, now in the interactions with Liza, you teach her to, I guess, speak first. Do we then go into other niceties with, I guess, his main goal is to win this bet, but do feelings get in the way?
You know, we debate this. We debate this every week in the 5 weeks so far that we've been in rehearsal. In fact, I think there's debate in the industry at large as what actually ends up with Higgins and Eliza. But, of course, I think there's some feelings that develop. What the level of those feelings are kind of where you mold the characters and see where you go with it. But, yeah, and for me, one of the pivotal moments is when she makes that transition from a Cockney to a lady. And I remember it was just last week we were rehearsing it, and I got goosebumps when we were doing the iconic The Rain in Spain, and the scene just clicked, and you felt it happening, and I'm getting goosebumps now thinking about it. But it's fascinating to see that transformation and to see what a strong woman she becomes through what he takes her through. So
I heard an interesting discussion on public television. It's been years ago, and I can't even remember the performers, but they had a mini debate on which character changed the most. Was it Higgins?
Yeah.
Was it Doolittle?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because he definitely goes through a metamorphosis now. Is it observably as different as hers? I don't know. I think a lot of that's internal, and I think he's very careful of what he lets us see. Mm-hmm. But he definitely gives us a glimmer that she has, and it's clearly been her. She changes him in some fashion.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. One of the fun things every night for me to watch in the show is to watch Higgins unravel as the show goes along. And that's a lot of fun, especially in the final scene of the show where Eliza's kind of taken over and she's become the lady and she's kind of creating what he is now. You kind of see that in that final scene.
Interesting.
It's a lot of fun to watch.
Interesting the way things often turn around as they do in real life.
Absolutely.
Well.
Art imitates life.
Yeah. That's true. And life imitates art sometimes. Mm-hmm. I'm always surprised that people kind of take their cues from a work of art that they see, and mm-hmm. they try to become that in a sense. Makes for some interesting shows in a while. Yeah. The costuming. You do it as a period piece, I'm assuming.
We are doing it as a period piece. The costumes are coming from Chicago.
Wow.
From professional productions in Chicago. So we'll have the full gamut of costumes. The ascot will be all done in the grays with the hats and the tailcoats and the morning suits. And then we go all the way from there to the ball. We see Eliza leaving for the ball, and that's where we end Act 1 with Eliza going to the ball. And we find out in Act 2 what happens to her.
Is this an effort by Leewood Stage to up the situation a little bit? Sounds like it.
I think so. You really can't do My Fair Lady without the beautiful costumes. I mean, because everybody expects that, the hats and the tweeds and the beautiful gray morning suit. So it's really part of the whole show. I think you get the whole experience when you come to see it. And plus the added, you know, of the choir and the orchestra and the great venue that we're going to be in. So it's they've really taken a step up with this one, I think.
Of all the musical you've done, and you've done them at Leewood Stage, and you've done it in a number of places. Yeah, fill the people in. And the Barn Player.
Yes, I've been at the Barn. EGAD's Theater. Theater in the Park. Okta. You know, pretty much everywhere around town, I've had my hand in something or other.
Is this one of the biggest challenges you've had with all that you said is involved here? Yeah. I'm going to think that you'll probably say yes, it is.
I would say it's one of the top two or three challenges I've had. It's a massive piece, and you have to, and as I was saying earlier, you have to dig past the music and get into the script. And it's like directing a play and then directing a musical as well. It's like two entities that you have to put together. So it has been a challenge, but I have a great cast, and they have all stepped up and really put their time in and their talent in, and it's going to be a beautiful production.
Well, and I'll say Kevin's done a great job, because for those who might be sitting out there going, oh, I remember this show, and it's like 3+ hours. He did a great job of working with the script and trimming some bits that I think were running, what, about 2 hours, 20 minutes?
Yes.
But still maintaining the integrity and the quality of the show, and I think people will be pleased with that they're not going to be investing a huge amount of time for the show. And it's come off great. He did a great job with trimming the script.
Yeah, I hope that doesn't mean sacrificing some of those great songs. All the classic ones are in there?
Every song is still in it.
Ah.
Every song. Yeah, we didn't sacrifice the music at all.
I find some of the numbers kind of fun. Early on when Higgins sings, you know, with a little bit of luck, you could have it all and not get hooked.
That's right.
That kind of tells you about his personality right there.
Yes, exactly. Exactly, yeah. The songs are just everyone. I mean, you'll put everyone you'll know. There's not one that you won't know.
Yeah, it kind of takes you back.
Yeah.
I don't think I've seen a production of it since it was at Starlight.
Really? Yeah.
Years ago.
Really?
And, I forget who the leads were.
Yeah.
But, when you put together a classic piece like that. Now, I'm not putting down the shows of today, but sometimes show where the audience, and, you know, I predict that you'll have a lot of people go who will say pretty much the same thing. I haven't seen this in years.
Yeah, right.
I knew all the songs. And there's some wonderful current musicals that are new in the last few years, especially. the Robert Brown one, especially Jason Robert Brown. But but some people like to hear the old classic songs too.
It's nice to be able to leave the theater humming a tune, and so many of the musicals today, they're wonderful, but they don't have the iconic melodies that My Fair Lady has, or you know, some of the other great Broadway shows, you know, The Music Man, those great songs of the golden age of musical theater. And you'll definitely leave singing some of these songs if you don't know them already.
Well, sure. Now, knowing the background on this, some of the finest actors of British history played this role. Did you think twice about auditioning for this part?
Well, no.
Can I possibly match this?
Well, of course there's that fear. And I think one of the interesting struggles that I have, and I'm sure everyone else in the cast is, as Kevin said earlier, you know, Rex Harrison set the mold. And you want to not disappoint people, but at the same time, you don't want to copy that or have people think that you're copying that. So, of course, I have not seen the movie probably in 10 or 15 years, and I didn't want to see it because I didn't want that to influence me. But, yeah, of course you're influenced that, because it is one of those shows, The Sound of Music, Oklahoma, where people know them, they know the songs, they know what they want to expect when they go to see that kind of show. So of course it's troubling, and then the English accent. I mean, oh my gosh, you're asked to do what is hopefully a believable English accent. I just a couple weeks ago went to see a show at Okta, and it was an English accent show, and I'm sitting there the whole time going, oh God, I hope I sound that good. I hope I don't sound that bad, you know. It's challenging. You don't want to disappoint people. But no, I wanted this role, and I would have paid any amount of money to get it.
Okay. And one, I don't know that I really think of Harrison as a singer, but he certainly did sing in this show, and well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he did. It was certainly, again, not his. I was, again, reading this morning that he, when they were opening in previews, the night that they were opening in previews, he said, I am not singing. I am not doing the show. And he didn't come out until about an hour before the show started. They had sent the cast home, but he changed his mind. And something like, I'm not going to do the show with those interlopers in the pit. Mm-hmm. And then he ended up singing it. And singing, speaking.
The interesting thing about the score is that every thing that Higgins speaks or sings is scored to sing.
Yeah.
So he has notes for everything, but Rex Harrison chose not to sing them. So probably 20 years ago I did a production of it, and the Henry Higgins decided, well, it's written to sing, so I'll sing it. And the songs are not very pretty if you sing them. So you pretty much have to speak them. You have to do it the way Rex Harrison did it, even though they weren't written that way. So that's the style everybody expects at this point.
Yeah.
And Brian does a great job. And Brian has a great voice. So when you do get to hear him sing Accustomed to Her Face at the end of the show, it's just glorious. But he really has done a great job of making the role his own. So you're not going to see a carbon copy of Rex Harrison doing the role.
Sure, so you sing rather than... I'm going to say chant, but
it's actually probably a pretty good mixture. There, mm-hmm. there are some times when I would call it rhythmically speaking the lines, so the lyrics, and then there are other times when I'm absolutely singing the notes, and both in the same song, because actually the words and the way you do the number lends itself to that. It's a mixture.
Yeah, I think the best example I can think of off the top of my head is The Rain in Spain. Mm-hmm. He says it, and he says it in his way, and then
Absolutely.
She says it as well in her way.
And you know the interesting thing about that number, and all of the members of the cast have said this, it's this huge, iconic number from this show. And the actual song itself, where the characters sing, maybe lasts a minute, maybe a minute and a half, and I may be on the long side of that. It's a very short number, but it is in our minds as the quintessential moment in that show.
Yeah, and plus you get what the weather is like in Spain.
Exactly.
Some great jokes in the movie.
Oh, I'll bet so. Well, the show is My Fair Lady, the musical version of George Bernard Shaw's book Pygmalion. And we heard some of the background of how it got turned into a musical. I think that's always nice to tell the people the background story of that. It's a presentation of the Leawood Stage Company, not in its usual digs, but in the United Methodist Church of the Resurrection, 13720 Roe Avenue, Leawood, Kansas. And we joked a little, but Kevin pointed out potential 3,000 seats there.
That's
for
right. Each night.
Each night. So we could have 9,000. Yeah, that's... altogether, that's the is that the biggest room you've done a musical in? Theater in the Park, maybe?
Absolutely. I haven't done Theater in the Park, but that's the biggest space that I've ever done a musical in, yes.
Yes. Is this the usual kind of musical that you do?
Well, I'm sort of new to community theater and musicals in the Kansas City area. It's been a while since college. I used to do a lot of them and loved them and then just missed it and wanted to get back into it. I did a show at the Barn last fall and loved it, and I was fortunate enough to be able to audition and convince Kevin that I should get this role, and I'm still thinking he's going to wake up and realize he made a mistake, but I'm thrilled. Yeah.
We're thrilled to have him in the theater community.
I'm sure. Right. Sure, of course. So the show, of course, opens up Thursday the 5th, just a few days away. We've got all those songs down. And
yes. But it's always being tweaked, you know. I think that's up until that moment. There's always something new that a spark happens and you're doing something new. Sometimes by accident things happen and you're like, keep it. Oh, my gosh, that's wonderful. But we're pretty much getting it set, though.
Yeah, things like that always tend to happen. Opens Thursday, May 5th at 7:30. Friday the 6th at 7:30. And again on Saturday the 7th at 7:30. I guess there's no Sunday matinee because they'll be having church.
We'll be resting.
In a different location, I want to stress that, because they'll drive on down to the clubhouse, if we don't, at the United Methodist Church of the Resurrection, 13720, so 137th Street, with a 20 at the end of it, Rowe Avenue, Leawood, Kansas. The number to call for more information, Leawood City Hall, probably Parks and Recreation Department, 913-339-6700, extension 157, or go online to leawoodstageco.org for more information. But with 3,000 seats available, I would think walk-ups would
just
be good.
Just come.
Yeah,
we'll have plenty of seats for you.
Okay, I want to thank my guests for being here and telling me all about it. Kevin Vogan, the director, he's directed many musicals. Maybe his biggest one ever.
Maybe,
who knows?
Maybe.
And Brian Larios, who plays the role of Henry Higgins, certainly picked a role to make your big breakout in. A difficult show. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you
for being with us today. The Leawood Stage Company and their production of My Fair Lady. Everything is bigger these days.
Yeah.
Really is. The Jazz Insider is next. Great jazz. He's got some wonderful things planned for you. Jazz from 1 to 3. Then we'll feature the blues from 3 to 6. KKFI is known for its jazz and its blues right here on your community radio station, 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City's community radio. So until next we meet, ladies and gentlemen, at that cross in the road, I'm Michael Hogue. We'll see you next time.